Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, in for Cynthia Canty. We'll continue our look at energy in Michigan on the show today. It's all about fracking. And then you've heard about Benton Harbor and Whirlpool, Battle Creek and Kellogg. We'll explore company towns and what they mean for the Michigan economy. But first, the Michigan Campaign Finance Network today released its 2012 Citizen's Guide to Michigan Campaign Finance entitled Descending into Dark Money. I'm sure you'll just be shocked, I tell you, to learn about record amounts of money being spent, even though there was less accountability for who was spending that money. Joining us now is Rich Robinson with the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Welcome, Rich.
Good to be with you.
So let's start with the big numbers. Overall, how much was spent for state campaigns last election?
$209 million, and that was by far a record for spending. I'm talking about state campaigns now, setting aside for the moment federal campaigns for the U.S. House and Senate. Most of that spending was driven by the ballot committees. There was $154 million raised and mostly spent on those ballot committees. We've never had anything like that before. That's at least five times as much as we've ever had.
I want to break those down a little later because I know that there was a lot of money spent on a couple of those. I wonder how much of the money that was spent, the $209 million we're talking about, how much of that was from reported sources and how much of that was from unreported sources or this so-called dark money?
Well, most of it was reported because the ballot committees had no reason not to report what they were doing. Now, some of the contributions to the ballot committees did come from corporate entities who aggregated money. So in that sense, there was dark money there. For example, the Michigan Chamber of Commerce put $11 million into the ballot committees. We don't know who they raised the money from. But I think the more important issue is when we talk about electing office holders, state representatives, members of the state education boards, and all of that spending was reported, and most particularly the judiciary and most particularly the Supreme Court. In the Supreme Court campaign, three-quarters of the money that was spent was off the books, and that's been a trend that's been developing over time, but it hit a new extreme in 2012. I mean, we've had as much as half the money not disclosed before, but this was unprecedented. And it seeped down into a trial court race. In the Oakland County Sixth Circuit campaign, there was a campaign where there were five incumbents running, two nominal challengers appeared on the ballot, and there was $2 million spent by nonprofit corporations based in Washington, D.C. So another case where three-quarters of the money involved in that campaign was off the books.
Now, you've been working with the Judiciary Task Force on this subject. This just adds to your arguments that here we have people who are supposed to be, A, nonpartisan, and, B, not being influenced by money of any kind. We're seeing all this unreported dark money for our justices and our judges. I mean, how disturbing do you think that is? How aware do you think citizens are about this?
Well, I don't think citizens really are aware, and they may be missing something about the importance of this, particularly for the judiciary. I mean, in all cases, citizens should know whose money is playing in an election campaign, but it's particularly important for a judicial campaign because if someone appears before a judge and that individual has helped elect the judge by spending extraordinary amounts of money, I think the opponent in the case has a legitimate claim that they can't possibly get an impartial court hearing in that environment. What we might call the Caperton problem for the U.S. Supreme Court case that ruled that it's not acceptable for a judge to rule in a case involving an extraordinary campaign contributor. So it not only compromises citizens' rights to know, it also compromises impartial justice. So this is something that just has to be cleaned up. And you mentioned the Judicial Selection Task Force, and I'd say that they were looking around the corner when they made their recommendation that all money in judicial campaigns needs to be disclosed to its source, because it certainly appeared this year like it never has before.
So has there been any action on the task force recommendations? Are we seeing any response from the legislature?
No real response from the legislature. There were some meetings at the time that the report was released, but there really hasn't been any action on this front. And, you know, it's my opinion that there's another route to correcting this right now, and that is that the interpretation of our state campaign finance law really goes back to a response to a request for a declaratory ruling in 2004. And at the time, the Department of State said, well, unless a communication has words of express advocacy, vote for, vote against, it would be too much for us to ask the sponsor to reveal their donors, so we won't. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has moved on, and in a case called Federal Election Commission against Wisconsin Right to Life, they said, you know, authentic issue advocacy is when the sponsor of an ad is trying to move viewers or listeners to contact a public official who can act on a matter of policy. And their lawyer in this case described it as grassroots lobbying. Well, in Michigan, judges aren't lobbyable officials, and the notion that quote-unquote issue advertising has anything to do with moving policy is just a fiction. These are cases where sponsors, mainly the major political parties, are being coy with their language and ducking under any requirement for disclosure.
So is this something the Secretary of State could do something about? I mean, could this be a ruling?
It is, but she won't respond, or the department won't respond, until there is a request for a declaratory ruling on this. And I think the legal profession, as a profession, needs to step up to this issue. I would certainly think that this would be an issue of interest to judges and have this matter clarified. But absolutely, this is a decision that is within the purview of the Department of State, and I think that's where it needs to happen.
You mentioned the state political parties. They're taking an ever-growing role of unreported dark money. Can you contrast what they report and what they actually spend?
Well, the state Republican Party reported that it spent $1.7 million, and it actually spent $8.8 million. The state Democratic Party reported $3.7 million spent, and they actually spent over $11 million. So the long and short of it is the Republican Party reported 20% of what they spent. The Democratic Party reported 30% of what they spent. And I'm being generous in saying that they reported that much, because they did other things that I wasn't able to quantify. I'm able to quantify what they spend on television because there are a limited number of stations that I visit, collect records from their public files, and report on that. But for example, in the Supreme Court campaign, the Michigan Republican Party sent out at least 13 pieces of direct mail about the candidates that I've collected, and only two of those were reported. So they're the greatest part of their mission, I guess, financially, is to obscure the source of the funds that they spend in political campaigns. And it's disgraceful.
The Internal Revenue Service has been in some hot water for its so-called BOLO lists. BOLO stands for Be on the Lookout, in regards to Tea Party or Patriot groups, and now we learn also some progressive groups. And while it's a big political story, a scandal, it seems to me that these nonprofits who declare they're not involved in political campaigns actually are involved in political campaigns through this dark money. I wonder if you think the IRS really should be investigating some of these groups because they just might be in violation of their nonprofit status.
Well, I think that that's exactly the case. And I think some of the nonprofits are actually known and established that need to be investigated as to whether they're abiding by the requirements of their tax status. But the fact that all of these groups appeared beginning in 2010 after the Citizens United decision came down suggested to me that they thought that they were going to be able to exploit the fact that corporations were going to be able to speak directly in election campaigns, and they would have the advantage of providing anonymity for donors. And it happened on both sides, but particularly on the right with the Tea Party organizations. The IRS is in a very difficult situation in that their staff has been reduced repeatedly over the years. They are overmatched by the situation. I have a degree of sympathy with what they did. I don't think anybody should be discriminated against, but certainly I think that there were a lot of organizations that emerged at that time that were deserving of scrutiny.
Rich Robinson is Executive Director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Rich, as always, we appreciate your work.
Well, thanks for having me on, Lester.
You can find a link to the Michigan Campaign Finance Network's new document, The Descending into Dark Money, on MichiganRadio.org. Still to come, we continue our week-long look at energy in Michigan. Today, fracking. That's next here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Right now, we have abundant supplies of natural gas because of what the U.S. Energy Information Administration calls robust inshore production. There's a glut of natural gas, and that means cheaper gas. This increased supply is mostly due to hydraulic fracturing. More importantly, a newer way to use the drilling method, horizontal hydraulic fracturing. Horizontal fracking has made it easier and cheaper to extract natural gas and oil from shale deposits in the U.S. and other sites around the globe, for that matter. Horizontal fracking has meant a boom in gas drilling in the U.S., and it's meant more jobs in certain areas of the country. It's meant less dependence on foreign sources for energy. And because burning natural gas emits about half the CO2 emissions of coal or oil, it means less of the greenhouse gases that are causing climate change. It also means families can heat their homes more cheaply. But there are also risks and concerns. The extraordinary expansion of natural gas extraction through this use of horizontal hydraulic fracturing is causing some real concerns about risks to air and water quality. Joining us now to talk about some of those risks are Andy Hoffman, professor of sustainable enterprise at the University of Michigan, and Abram Lustgarten, a reporter for ProPublica, and in my estimation, the preeminent journalist on horizontal fracking in the nation. First, Abram, let's start with you. Tell us what horizontal hydraulic fracturing is and how it differs from the method of vertical hydraulic fracturing.
Well, sure. To drill a well, a pipe is installed deep into the ground, down to whatever layer of geology holds the oil or gas deposit. And in traditional fracking, then pressure is created with injected water and chemicals and sand in a mixture. So much pressure that it cracks the rock down at that great depth and creates this system of fractures that allows like trapped bubbles of gas, in this case, to flow freely out of the well. Now, if you picture this geological layer as kind of like a horizontal film somewhere, anywhere from 2 to 10,000 feet below the surface, what a horizontal well does is goes down to that layer. Instead of just piercing it perpendicular to that geological formation, it actually turns. It makes a 90-degree turn and then runs horizontally through that geological layer, through that little sandwich layer, for some distance. And that means that the well is significantly longer. It holds more fluid, more chemicals, and just involves a whole lot more material to do the same kind of fracturing process that happens vertically.
And also ends up being a little more productive in some cases.
Yes, it can, because you're tapping a significantly larger portion of that geological layer and that resource deposit with one well.
Okay, so this new method of natural gas and oil extraction has been used in a lot of other states, and there have been some problems in other states. Can you give us a couple of examples?
Well, sure. You know, I've looked at problems pretty much everywhere that the drilling process is employed. You see and hear complaints about degradation of people's water quality in private wells, sometimes in public water systems, and even natural waterways, streams and drainages. There's significant degradation of air quality in intensive drilling areas, both as ozone-depleting chemicals are emitted and degrade the ozone layer, and also as large amounts of methane are emitted, which contributes to climate change. And then there's all sorts of other, you know, regional and landscape kind of impact from truck traffic to new roads to, you know, all the pollution and accidents and other things that come along with that.
Andy Hoffman, here in Michigan, there have been a handful of these new wells drilled, but the outcry in Michigan has been pretty significant. There are concerns about all the things that Abram just mentioned, but especially about the amount of water needed to make these wells productive, the contamination of that water, concerns about groundwater being polluted. How valid are those concerns in Michigan?
Well, looking at public opinion polls in Michigan, there's a slight majority, 52%, who think the benefits outweigh the risks. On fracking. This is a study done out of the University of Michigan. But people are very concerned about water quality being the number one issue and what fracking might do to water quality, and particularly the amount of water that's used. The horizontal drilling gets into some very, very high volumes of water that's used, and then the use of the fracking muds and whether that will contaminate the water table.
And one of the things we should point out, it takes millions of gallons, mm-hmm. 2 to 8 million gallons, to frack one of these wells. And once that water is mixed with the chemicals and so forth that is used in this fracking fluid, that water really can't be cleaned up. It's taken out of the water cycle. It's put in these deep injection wells. So is that the main concern people are talking about? I know a lot of trout anglers have been concerned that these wells near their favorite river or creek are a big, big deal to them.
Well, you know, we could talk about actual risk. We could talk about perceived risks. They're both equally important in the public debate. And the public debate is important because people vote, they can protest, and so what they understand and what they perceive. And people respond very strongly to risks that they think are imposed upon them. And right now, in many cases, the contents of the fracking muds are considered proprietary, and so the companies don't have to disclose them, and that makes people extremely uncomfortable and extremely skeptical.
Abram, we've been using vertical fracking in Michigan since the 1940s with few problems. The industry says we end up extracting more gas and using less fracking fluid with horizontal fracking, so it's actually better. I wonder what your thoughts are about that claim.
Well, you know, I tend to disagree with the idea that the distinction between vertical and horizontal fracking makes a significant difference in terms of its environmental impact. I mean, the main difference is the huge volume of fluid that's required for horizontal drilling. There's some truth to the idea that there's less impact on the land surface because one well can cover such a larger area. So that certainly minimizes some of the environmental impact, but on the other hand, there are far greater volumes of chemicals used in a horizontal well than in a vertical well. But when you get down to the geology and the core issues, when you're talking about different volumes of fluid and waste, the risks are more or less the same. The risks of where those pollutants may or may not be able to travel to underground, and then the challenge of how you dispose of all of that wastewater when it comes back up to the surface and where you put it. I mean, those are really the same, whether you're drilling vertically or horizontally.
So where this fracking fluid goes, which could include all kinds of nasty chemicals, the big risk is coming back up the pipe or going down the pipe under pressure, because that goes through the sensitive parts where our groundwater is. Now, in Michigan, we have more stringent regulations on the constructions of these wells and the disposal of the fracking fluid. Do you think people in Michigan should be as concerned about this process as perhaps other states that have less stringent regulations?
Well, yeah, there's still significant. I'm not intimately familiar with Michigan's regulations, but under federal law, the wastewater disposal is regulated differently from the injection process for the fracking itself. And I think that gap is the critical difference. When you look at federal wastewater disposal regulations for underground injection, you know, the law was designed and written in a way to minimize risks of polluting underground aquifer systems when a fluid or a chemical is injected underground. The fracking process essentially does exactly the same thing, but it's not regulated in the same way, just because it's defined as an oil and gas production process instead of a waste disposal process.
Which was exempted by an act of Congress, as I recall.
It was. It was exempted as part of the 2005 Energy Policy Act. It was exempted from the Safe Drinking Water Act, which is the main federal statute that governs what happens to water underground.
Andy, recently there was a town hall meeting on fracking held at the University of Michigan, and a DEQ official revealed that there are 25 inspectors to monitor 12,000 active wells in this state. Is that adequate?
I think the answer to that question is self-evident. In fact, that comment that came up at the town hall was met with some nervous grumbling to amused laughter when that number was stated, and stated that there was enough inspectors to cover that volume of activity.
I'm wondering, this newer horizontal fracking method has been around for a relatively short time. What kind of scientific research has been done to better determine the risks? I know, Abram, you've done some research on that. Is there much science to determine whether this is good enough or not?
Well, there's not nearly enough. Research has begun over the last couple of years. There's certainly been a lot of progress. But again, you know, the geological sciences, the risks are similar, then the understanding is similar, whether you're talking about vertical or horizontal wells. What I hear from the scientific community is the presumption of safety when it comes to drilling is based on an assumption that when you go so deeply underground, there's and quite logically, there's a great separation between that deep injection zone and the surface, or even the near surface where drinking water aquifers exist. And because there's such a great separation, it should be impossible for contaminants to travel through them. What I hear from geoscientists that I've talked to in my research is that's really an assumption that's not based on scientific research, and to the extent that there is scientific research, they're actually finding the opposite, and they're discovering a number of new possible pathways where contaminants can flow, and this is sort of theoretical, but not only natural fractures and faults in the rock that actually connect from thousands of feet below to near the surface, but when a well itself is drilled, the well becomes, and the well bore in the space inside and outside of that steel and cement casing becomes a new pathway, a man-made pathway that can potentially connect deep contaminants to surface waters. And that's why well construction guidelines are such a critical part of this conversation. But to get right to your question, there's actually very little research that's actually tracked what happens to the contaminants, the fate of the contaminants over a long period of time. The papers that have been published recently, including by the National Academy of Sciences, put the risk of contamination on a time scale of 50 to 100 to even several hundred years. So the expectation that we can know over the course of a year or two or 10 exactly what the long-term impacts will be from the injection of all this material underground is a little bit flawed just by its nature.
And I might add that in the state of Michigan, there's been a great deal of oil drilling and closed and abandoned wells throughout Michigan, many of which are not documented. We don't know where they are. So those could be pathways that Abram's talking about as well.
So I was talking to a geologist at Michigan State University, and I've talked to some engineers at the University of Michigan. I can kind of affirm what Brahma says. They don't seem to have a lot of answers. They've got a lot of ideas and speculations about it, but I understand there's a greater effort to actually do some research here in Michigan.
Mm-hmm. You know, something else we should bring into this conversation, if you don't mind, is the social aspects of drilling. There's this concern over a boomtown effect. that all this heavy equipment comes in, all this workers come in, they do the initial work. Perhaps some tax revenues go up, the roads get degraded, property values may get affected, and a lot of people are quite concerned about what will happen to their local communities, their local environment, and that needs to be attended to as well. And then just adding to the conversation, public opinion supports more regulation of this activity across the board. Public opinion supports the disclosure of chemicals and hydroxyflacking fluids, increased regulation of natural gas industry, and an imposition of a severance tax. 77% of people in Michigan favor a severance tax, 65% in Pennsylvania.
So why don't you explain what do you mean by severance
tax? Well, severance tax is you extract a tax for the oil companies come in, the gas companies, they extract the natural gas, and the tax rate is used to perhaps lower local property rates, perhaps support state research on alternative energy, or reduce government debt. Those are actually where people would prefer that money go in public opinion surveys.
I know up north where they're used to a lot of gas drilling, especially around the Gaylord area and even as far as Traverse City, that there seems to be an acceptance of this. And for some landowners who are, you know, getting these proposed leases from what they call the landmen, the representatives who, you know, basically bargain with a property owner to allow them to drill, it is seen as, wow, this is great profit. But I noticed in Lenawee County and around the Adrian area and the Irish Hills area of Michigan, there's not been a lot of drilling there in the past, and suddenly there is a lot of drilling. Even in the city of Adrian, I saw a drilling rig within the city limits erected the other day, which I found fascinating. Mm. So there's a lot of concern in that region about it. They're not used to this kind of drilling. I'm just wondering, are we going to, as we see more extraction in places we haven't seen it before, whether you expect public outcry to get larger, or is it going to continue to be this 52% approval?
No, I think there are two points to what you're saying here. First of all, many people just hear the word fracking, and in the public parlance, it's any activity. Once they see the well, it's fracking. And
right.
And when you talk to industry representatives, it's the specific aspect of injecting fluids in and withdrawing. Secondly, this does divide communities where you suddenly have this massive influx of wealth that's disproportionate. That if you own land and you can and sell those rights, then you can pit neighbor against neighbor. It can be very fractious and within a community, and certainly when people are not used to this activity, when it's new coming in as opposed to being used to it, there's certainly more acceptance in the latter.
Abram, it seems that we will continue to exploit natural gas and oil resources using horizontal hydraulic fracturing. What would you recommend we do to safeguard the environment and drinking water?
Well, the primary thing that I hear from pretty much everybody I talk to in government and in academia is some measure of enhanced regulations, and it kind of comes back to this, what I was mentioning before, the Safe Drinking Water Act regulations of underground injection. There's a lot of discussion now about how one might regulate hydraulic fracturing, whether it should be regulated and so forth, and the conversation really just skips over the fact that conversation happened previously, 25, 35 years ago when the Safe Drinking Water Act was written. Congress, bipartisan members of Congress, and the Environmental Protection Agency evaluated the risks of injecting fluids underground. They found that there was quite serious risk and cause for concern. There's dozens of contamination sites across the country where aquifers, drinking water aquifers, have been polluted with oil and gas waste or nuclear waste and so forth. And they wrote a whole suite of regulations to address that, and they came up with very specific methods that would reduce the risk. And those are the regulations that hydraulic fracturing is now exempted from. And so I think a starting point from what I hear from sources is that applying those regulations would go a very long way towards improving the safety and making this process a little bit more sustainable going forward.
Of course, those days 25 years ago, that was before Drill Baby Drill was around, so I think things have changed politically anyway in the past few years. We're almost out of time, but I wanted to end by actually quoting you, Abram. You wrote, quote, "Gas is a wonderful resource, and it's very important to the United States. Water is as well. And to discount the importance of water in the short term, to assume without scientific knowledge that water will be protected or that it's not at risk, makes the country and makes the state of Michigan and other states vulnerable to having made a great mistake and possibly regretting not implementing some small and simple steps that could have protected that resource in the first place. Or the way I like to say it is, we're going to get this gas out. We're going to extract it. We're going to burn it. It's going to go away. Water is forever.
Absolutely.
Abram Lustgarten is a reporter for ProPublica. I appreciate the extensive reporting you've been doing on this issue. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Andy Hoffman is professor of sustainable enterprise at the University of Michigan. Andy, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Good to talk to you, Lister.
Still to come, we'll head overseas and check in on fracking in Europe, how it's perceived there, and what it's meant for the European economy. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Continuing our conversation on fracking, Michigan and the U.S. are certainly not the only places on the planet dealing with this issue. It's starting to be a problem, or at least an issue, in Europe as well. So joining us is BBC reporter Russell Padmore. So Russell, where are you starting to see horizontal hydraulic fracturing, and what's been the response?
It's interesting, actually, that here in Europe, there's an awful lot of opposition against rock fracturing, hydraulic rock fracturing or fracking, largely on environmental grounds. In the north of England, last year, we heard complaints that maybe a company called Quadrilla were responsible for earthquakes. But the main concern here in Europe has been environmental concerns, pollution to water supplies in particular. I can tell you right now, France has got a ban on fracking. We've had beer brewers in Germany urging the government to make sure there are bans on it because they are quite fearful of contamination to groundwater. You can understand the beer industry is quite a key sector for industry in Germany. It's worth bearing in mind that Western Europe relies on gas coming from Russia. About 30, maybe 40% sometimes in the winter of our gas, natural gas, is coming from Russia. So in theory, the development of the huge gas reserves, the shale gas here in many nations, could actually help reduce this European reliance on supplies from Russia. I should tell you the UK has lifted its moratorium on rock fracturing a few months ago. Romania has as well. The Netherlands or Holland is re-evaluating its ban right now.
So what are they doing to ensure that there are regulations in place so you can avoid contamination of water sources and the other problems associated with fracking?
Well, this is where the politicians come in, particularly at the European Union level, monitoring what's going on in all nations from Brussels. I should say, though, that European Union's energy policies have been for several years now to lean on these old smokestack industries. Think of the chemical industry, for example. These industries are trying to fit in with new rules and regulations to be much greener, to reduce their carbon emissions, and that's adding to their costs. Now, it's kind of interesting that many companies, indeed several countries here, those who are in favour of rock fracturing, look to the United States and say, look, those shale gas reserves are proving quite a cheap source of energy for many companies.
One final question, Russell. In the United States, we're still quite heavily reliant on coal for energy production. They're arguing that using this cheaper natural gas means half the CO2 emissions. I know that's an important issue in the UK. Is that being used as an argument there to displace some of the coal-generated power?
Well, we've been in a situation here in Europe for a long time that natural gas has been the growing source of the energy that these power stations use to fire themselves up to produce electricity. Complaints for many years about so-called acid rain landing here in the UK from those smokestack chimneys of German coal-fired power stations, and there is a greater move towards natural gas. I mentioned shale gas, for example. Here's one of the huge problems. Poland, we know, according to all the reports, has huge reserves of shale gas. Rock fracturing, the fracking process, could be the way to go for Poland. Many US and Canadian energy companies plan to explore in the country. The trouble is, of 13 wells planned, only two got drilled. The problem was that the local government in Warsaw suddenly started insisting that these foreign companies have a local partner, then suddenly punitive taxes got slapped on the industry. We saw the likes of ExxonMobil, Talisman and Marathon Oil basically walking away from Poland. There's still such huge opposition on largely environmental grounds here in Europe, and it's going to be a challenge for those who see it as a cheap source of energy, getting over all of those concerns about pollution to water supplies. We have a huge argument going on here, and there doesn't look like any answer to it in the short term.
Russell Padmore is a business reporter with the BBC. Thanks very much.
Thanks. Good being with you.
When you hear the term company town, you might think of Dow in Midland or Ford in Dearborn or Kellogg in Battle Creek, Whirlpool in Benton Harbor. But too many cities in Michigan have realized just how dependent they are on a single industry when the major employer shuts its plant down. Think about GM in Flint, or the Ford plant in Monroe, or any other number of towns that have lost major employers during Michigan's so-called lost decade. Mid-sized and smaller towns have known for some time they need to diversify the employment base, but that's a job with a lot of obstacles. Joining me now are two men who've researched this issue. George Erichcheck is a senior regional analyst with the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, and Richard Longworth is a senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs and the author of the book Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. So Michigan has been dominated by auto manufacturing, which during the good times has made Michigan a pretty wealthy state. But when it struggles, Michigan economy is really hit hard. While the state's been making some efforts to diversify, really this kind of starts in the city where economic developers have to take a hard look at the mixed blessing of having one major employer. George Erichcheck, give some examples of towns that have been devastated by big plants shutting down. What should these smaller cities be considering as they assess their own situation?
Well, the two that come to mind immediately would be, of course, Flint and Saginaw, where they had very good employers, both of them associated with the auto industry, providing really good wages and people working very hard. And the real challenge for both of these communities is that these major industries, the auto industry, developed a culture of working really hard for good wages that is a culture that is going to be more difficult to transform into one of entrepreneurship. I think they're both making headway on this, but that's the challenge. And the other challenge is both these areas, Flint and Saginaw, have very thin labor markets, which means that if they are able to diversify, they do have a challenge in attracting professional workers who tend to come in pairs. And with pairs mean that they also have to find jobs for their spouses.
Right. And I want to talk about the thin labor pool in a little bit. Richard Longworth, how does a city deal with the idea that it's not just competing with other states for employers, but it's competing with the world? What can these smaller cities do about that?
I think getting to what we're talking about, when a local economy is dominated by a big corporation, as George was talking about, this is a big problem because a lot of these jobs tied with big corporations are going overseas. You have seen this, certainly, in your places in Michigan that you were talking about. A poster child for a lot of this is Peoria, Illinois, where Caterpillar has always dominated the economy, still does. 16,000 jobs, no joke. But that's a lot fewer jobs than there used to be, and wages there are going down. Caterpillar is now in negotiations to cut wages, cut benefits. So a city like this, it's not going to throw Caterpillar away. It can't. It's a valuable citizen. But it can't really rely on Caterpillar for its future the way it used to do in its past. So it has to diversify. Talking with economic development specialists, a lot of them are a little worried about this diversification thing because they feel it would tell their major employer, like Caterpillar, that they don't trust them anymore. It hurts their feelings, in a sense. It's a very touchy issue.
So they're spending most of their time on business retention rather than attraction.
Yes.
Now, if you already have a major employer which might pay good wages, like we were talking about, how do you attract employers and, for that matter, potential employees when the labor pool might be pretty tight or thin, as you described it, George?
Well, I think one of the concepts in economic development is always trying to develop your cluster. So if you do have a major employer, of course you want to try and make sure that they're happy. But second, you want to make sure that your supplier base is as complete as possible. So one of the attraction efforts would be to make sure that the supplier base,
that is able to supply Caterpillar or GM or Ford within your local area is as strong as it can be. One of the things I'm fascinated by in economic development is there seems to be tension between industrial clusters, which seem to be more competitive, and the need, as Richard says, to diversify. And I think that's something that the economic development community is really struggling to deal with.
I was going to say, is the expertise within these economic development communities at the local level sophisticated enough to take this bigger look at diversification?
It's become kind of a cliche that for the industrial Midwest, the past is gone. Now let's build on the past. Let's ask ourselves what we know. There's a lot that we know. We know cars, for instance. The big assembly lines are going or gone, but you have a lot of smaller companies using very high-end knowledge in auto design, R&D, that sort of thing. We really know this stuff. Toledo, Ohio, they don't make that much auto glass anymore, but they are developing new ways of using glass in high-end industries. Akron, Ohio, tire capital of the world. They don't make tires there anymore, but they know polymers, which is a molecule that's used in rubber making, so they have the basis of new industries there using polymers. Try and figure out what you know, not trying to import something new, not trying to be the new Silicon Valley, but figure out what you know, where your expertise is, and then go for the high-end stuff that really can compete in this new global economy.
Right. You mentioned Toledo. They're starting to make solar panels there, so they're using that glass technology for this. Let me just ask you, you mentioned Toledo and Akron. Are there examples of cities which have redefined themselves successfully after losing a major employer? I keep hearing about Yellow Springs, Ohio, which is really trying hard to redefine itself. Are there success stories?
That's hard to say. Possibly the best might be right here. I'm in Chicago right now, and Chicago has done this. We used to have the stockyards. We had all this meat packing here. Well, we don't have that anymore, but we still have our financial markets, LaSalle Street. Once upon a time, they did pork bellies. They traded in pork bellies. Don't do much of that anymore, but they know trading.
Yeah, you guys were the hog butcher to the world at one time. Yeah.
That's right. Now we've taken the knowledge that we had from trading and turned it into new financial markets that are real force in the economy here in the city. The big problems in this, and one of the big problems in a lot of these new industries, do they employ as many people as the old industrial base used to? The answer so far is no, and that's a big problem.
And to build on a couple of comments that Richard has made, which I totally agree with, the first is regarding whether or not the local economic developers in many of these communities are aware of the challenges. I think they are, and we see that in their drive to push their companies to explore new markets, to explore new products, to new fields. The second thing is that even for those areas that are able to diversify and recreate themselves, the troubling factor is that many of the workers, that's a very hard transition to make. Not only are there fewer jobs in some of these alternative production and service functions, but they require different skills. So I always imagine a 45-year-old working mom with two kids, and she's been working in manufacturing for 25 years. It's really difficult to see how, in many instances, she can change over to a totally new industry or a new product line. So that's the challenge. Not only are the new job, the new businesses maybe employing fewer workers because of productivity, but at the same time, they require different skill sets.
These are people, George, that whenever you get the change from a major economic change, like from the industrial era to the global era, if you get caught in something like that, you're in trouble. And this is a generation that is caught in this squeeze between two different economies, and I don't know what's going to happen to them. My hope is that these new industries and new development are going to provide good jobs for their kids. What's going to happen to this middle generation? In many ways, it's a tragedy, and we're seeing it playing out here in the Midwest.
Yeah, the only thing that I can hope for and turn to is a more aggressive role on the part of the community colleges to try and retrain individuals. There are 1 or 2 year retraining programs. It's amazing. Sometimes you do hear of success stories of someone who's been in manufacturing, who's been able to retrain into healthcare. But for a lot of the individuals, it's a very tough situation. And without, except for the avenue that community colleges can provide, I'm not quite sure what's going to happen either.
So let's say the two of you have a chance to sit down with city leaders, economic developers in a region in Michigan that currently has one of these major employers. What are the top three things you'd recommend they do immediately?
I would go with what George said. Really work with community colleges, but also talk to these big employers, the Caterpillars of the world. They are moving jobs out. They're not going to be the force in the economy in the future, but they're still based there, and a lot of their executives live there, and try to get them involved in a program to work with community colleges and local four-year colleges, working with to get venture capital, to get business plans, to work to build up incubators, to try and create new industries, to persuade these employers to help build a new industry, not that the old companies are going, but these new industries are needed, and I think that is the first thing, to work with the economic power that you have and to work with the community colleges and the schools to try and tap a lot of the good ideas that are growing up there.
The other thing I would add, is that we have to think beyond the city now, it's really important for these individual cities to think regionally and start looking at regional answers to some of these issues. So it's very possible that some of these cities, especially the smaller cities, could be totally built out, that they're chock full. Maybe they have a lot of abandoned buildings. But we're talking about commuter patterns for their residents. So the key is, I think, to adopt a regional approach so that you can help provide these additional job opportunities that are 40 minutes away, which is a commute, but one that can still keep the residents employed. And the second thing is that when you do talk to these major companies, one thing that they are interested in is keeping their talent in the area. And so as for a city, it's really important to make sure that the level of service and the quality of service and of cultural activities are such that these areas still stay attractive as these major companies try and bring talent into the region.
That's something the Michigan Municipal League talks about a lot. They call it placemaking. I'm wondering, one final question, a little prediction from both of you. Are we going to get to a place where we can stop calling the Midwest the Rust Belt and we might drive that regional effort to redefine it?
Well, that's a good question. We've got a long ways to go. We have a lot of rebuilding to do. I'm not entirely sure some of these old cities actually are going to come back. It depends on their ability to do this. One of the big changes, and George, I'd be interested to know if you've seen the same thing. About 5 or 6 years ago, you had civic leaders that realized what was going on. They realized this time was different, that the old days were gone. They really didn't have an awful lot of ideas what to do about it. I'm seeing a new generation of leaders, the new mayor of Flint, new mayor of Gary, the new mayor of South Bend, who not only understand what's going on, but have fresh ideas, who are willing to work regionally, and which, you know, as George said, and he's absolutely right, who are willing to work with local schools, who are willing to reach out across political boundaries. There's a new generation of leadership coming in, and I'm very encouraged by it.
Joe Jerichek, last word.
Last word is, when we think about Rust Belt, we immediately think about manufacturing. And I think Richard said that we can't let manufacturing go. It's going to employ fewer people. But I think we still want to keep the manufacturing belt here. What we want to do is we want to sand off some of that rust.
Joe Jerichek is a senior regional analyst with the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. Richard Longworth is a senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Gentlemen, thanks very much for talking with us.
It was enjoyable.
Lester, thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Zeitgeist-Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Saha, Katie Theory, April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. Thanks for listening. Let's talk again tomorrow.